Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, and healthcare and science in the news. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, there are a lot of interesting things in the news this week, and sat here this morning thinking, okay, what do I start with? And I like this one. How exactly does your brain benefit from meditation? A team at Yale has been studying this using functional MRI scans. And functional MRI, you'll remember, looks at blood flow and presumably glucose utilization in various parts of the brain, and therefore tells you what parts are being active. So they looked at the MRIs of advanced meditators and novice meditators. So both groups were trying to do the same thing. And they did three different meditation techniques. One of them was the sort of mantra. One of them was what's called mindfulness meditation. And I don't know what the third was. But in any event, all three meditation techniques had pretty much the same effect on functional MRI in the advanced meditators. And what they found was that they had decreased activity in the areas of the brain called the default mode network, which is implicated in lapses of attention and also seen as having higher activity in people with anxiety, attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, and also Alzheimer's disease. This is an area that is subject to buildup of quite a few beta amyloid plaques in people who have Alzheimer's. So decreased activity in this network, which is located in the medial, prefrontal, and posterior cingulate cortex, was seen in whatever type of meditation. When this place is active, the areas of the brain that are associated with just paying attention to yourself and controlling your thoughts were activated in the experienced meditators, but not the novices. In other words, the meditators were constantly monitoring and suppressing the emergence of mind wandering or me thoughts. And they did this during meditation, but this is more important. Even when they weren't meditating, when they were just resting or not doing anything in particular, the meditators who were practice meditators had a new default mode of thinking, which was less self-directed and more outwardly directed. And I can attest certainly to that little voice in your head that's reminding you at 3 a.m. of all the things you have to do tomorrow and where you messed up and what you're worried about and what hurts and what makes you unhappy. That little voice, we could turn that voice off by just practicing meditation. I think our lives would be much richer and happier. And I think that little voice is the brain region that they're talking about, this default mode network. So if you can change your default mode to something that's less me-oriented, more outwardly directed, you are a happier person, and your brain looks like that of someone who's an experienced meditator. So maybe we should all take up meditation. Now, for something completely different, this is a new way of sterilizing hospital rooms and also any space. It also kills bed bugs, which have been very much in the news lately. It's a new technology, and it's basically a gas with ozone and hydrogen peroxide vapor, and it's put into a room, and it sterilizes everything, floors, walls, drapes, mattresses, gets into upholstery. It's very effective at killing bacteria and can be used, takes about an hour, it can be used to sterilize a hospital room. And actually, a major U.S. hotel chain is looking into this technology as well. There are lots of similarities to this ozone and hydrogen peroxide mix. And what we actually do ourselves to sterilize bacteria in the human body. In fact, the recipe that they are using was stolen from your macrophages, which are the large amoeba cells that wander around, for example, in the lining of your lungs and eat all the bacteria you breathe in and sterilize them by using hydrogen peroxide. So taking a page from Mother Nature and treating the entire room in the hospital as a lysosome, It's a very, very cool idea. And the nice thing about these products, ozone and hydrogen peroxide, is that they break down to things that are very safe for the environment. And that's a very big plus when you think about all the environmental challenges that we already face in a hospital trying to get things clean and keep them safe. So I'm hoping to see this technology get deployed very quickly. We're going to go to our first caller now, and that is Larry in Georgia. Hello, Larry, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Bob.
Hi.
Thank you so much. And number one, I want to wish you and yours a very happy holiday.
Thank you.
Also, Dr. Dawn, I want to follow up on my prostate condition. You and I spoke about maybe 4 weeks ago, give or take. I called you and said that recently I'd gone to a community hospital prostate screening, examination. And after getting a physical examination, the doctor told me he saw some nodules. Told you about that.
Right, I remember. And then you had the PSA test.
Yes. In fact, the PSA was 0.75. In fact, very briefly, I kind of organized my PSA tests over the past couple of years, and they have always been below 1%. They've always been low. I actually was able to go to a local urologist, and it was very kind, and he didn't find anything unusual, and advised me to come back maybe in 6 months or a few months and have another PSA. I want to call you and kind of give your feedback on that idea.
Well, okay. It sounds to me like you had two different prostate exams, one done at a screening setting and one done by an experienced urologist.
Yes.
And the urologist trumps the screening setting. Okay. The concept here is that when we screen, we're sort of throwing out a wide net, like a drag net, and anything that's the least little bit abnormal, we flag for future investigating. And you might think in terms of, say, a police investigation where you make a big, you watch all these procedural police shows. I'm sure that's a kind of a cultural vice that we all share. So, they put up all these pictures on their board and then they start knocking people out because they couldn't have been there or they have an alibi or whatever. And that's essentially what we do with screening in a medical setting. Anyone who's got, there's a little lump there, maybe that's nothing, maybe that's something, we'll put them over in that category and look more carefully. And that's what you've done with the PSA. And the urology visit, you've done the look more carefully and effectively been exonerated. So at this point, I'm totally with the urologist. If he doesn't think he can feel anything, then it was a false alarm. And go ahead and get checked again in a few months to make sure nothing's changed, but I think you can relax.
Can I ask you a fascinating question?
Very quick, yes.
Very quickly. I want to ask, what's the relationship between weight and prostate cancer or large prostate, gland?
I don't believe that there's any direct relationship between being overweight and having an enlarged prostate. There is statistically an increased risk of prostate cancer that may be related directly to being overweight, or it may be related to the way you get overweight. In other words, if you eat high fat, high saturated fat, and you have a lot of oxidated free radicals in your system, insulin goes up in people who are heavy. Insulin is inflammatory. So the presence of the increased inflammation and the free radicals it generates might be carcinogenic, as opposed to it being directly the body weight. It could be what you're putting in your mouth to get fat that also gives you prostate cancer. And realistically, we haven't quite untangled that thread of association to be able to say for sure which of those it is.
And Dr. Dawn, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to Robert in Soquel. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the program.
I've been practicing this this question, but I'm just going to just get into it. The fishy odor, the vaginal fishy odor, is easily correctable, or any ideas from you?
Sure. There's a fishy odor that's associated with a kind of infection called bacterial vaginosis. And in a lot of women, this odor, it's quite strong when you get one of these infections going,
mm-hmm.
and is unpleasant and embarrassing to the person who has it. It can be treated with topical antibiotics inserted into the vagina, or it can be treated with oral antibiotics, but it does tend to come back. And so the best way to keep it from coming back is to use probiotics. These can be actually placed in the vagina, or they can be taken orally, and either one seems to work. As women get a little bit older, they have a change in their pH in the vagina, and they're more subject to this problem. Vaginal pH should be about 4, and as it goes up into the 5 range, that becomes a problem. Another source of that fishy odor is actually semen and sperm. Sometimes that, because it has a pH of 7, will raise the pH enough for there to be a temporary bloom of that bad bacteria that's causing the odor. And then after the vagina, which is a self-cleaning organ, takes care of this pH issue, then the odor goes away. So it could be one or both of those factors working together. But in general, the odor is coming from breakdown of carbohydrates in the cells by bacteria, which produce this amine, and that's what you're smelling.
Vaginosis, per se, is it toxic to me?
No. If you are not circumcised, you might be giving it back to her, though, because the bugs can live underneath the foreskin. So people can, so to speak, play ping pong with an infection.
Last question. Even though the odor may be greatly diminished or barely detectable, is there a threat orally?
No threat at all.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Don.
All right. Bye-bye. Let's talk about microbes and colonization, since we got put on that topic. This is a recent study done at Duke University Medical Center, and they were looking at the microbia in the intestines of premature versus full-term infants. They used genomic typing of bacteria, fungi, and parasites, so they could tell exactly what kinds were present. When you do a culture method, you, of course, are biasing things in favor of oxygen-loving bacteria that can grow on whatever culture media you choose. Whereas by using a DNA method, you get a better idea of the proportions of the organisms that actually exist in the intestine. So from a technical standpoint, a very good study. And this was just published in the Open Access Journal Online, PLOS1, and it's the December 8th issue if you want to look it up. What the researchers found is quite interesting. All of the premature children had been placed on antibiotic treatments shortly after birth, but they were off the antibiotics and eating food at the time they were studied. Their digestive systems, however, had been profoundly affected by the antibiotics, and they found that they had mainly staph epidermidis growing in their digestive tracts, which is not commonly found in the regular neonates who were not premature. They also found yeast, which was something that can be a devastating infection if candida gets loose in the bloodstream in infants. So what we've got here is very strong presumptive evidence that we are harming our premature babies with these antibiotics that we give them. And I would say a call to arms about giving prenatals, especially premature babies, giving them probiotics, at least probiotics that are human-derived and match the ones that are found in the healthy neonates. It would be, I think, criminal if we didn't make a little bit of a leap of logic in our neonatal care and validate that concept right away rather than waiting for more evidence that this is a necessary thing. I think it would be just a great idea to fix the digestive tracts and model it on the healthy infant digestive tract from the start rather than waiting to prove that we have to do this. I think concerns about somehow doing harm to these preemies is far-fetched, and at least in my opinion, like I said, we should make that logical leap. A related topic about parenting studied chronic stress. Everyone who's ever raised a child knows when they're a toddler, the terrible twos period is a very, very difficult time, and everyone has a hard time dealing with that overactive little child who's so easily going to get themselves in trouble and is so reactive to frustration. A study here looked at several groups of mothers, mothers who had been diagnosed as depressed, mothers who were under extreme social stress, that is to say that they were struggling with poverty, and a group of quote-unquote normal control mothers. And they hooked them up to an EKG wireless device to monitor their heart rate because they used heart rate as their indicator for stress. They studied about 153 women, and the babies were aged 17 to 19 months old. Using the wireless monitor, each mother's stress response was measured, first during a distressing situation in which the child was left with a stranger, and then later on while they were playing together. And they were videotaped, and then the playing was analyzed for hostility, detachment, engagement, and other sorts of scorable interactions that could be, well, scored by psychology grad students watching the videotapes later on. And then they correlated it. And what they found was that people who live in dangerous neighborhoods and poverty suffer a hypoactive, underactive stress response. In other words, their stress response is just burnt out. They showed the lowest levels of stress when their child was separated from them and cried. And during the free play, they had the hardest time engaging. They were mostly just passively watching and not interacting with their child, even though they'd been instructed to interact. In contrast, and I found this very counterintuitive, the depressed mothers were actually overstressed. They had exaggerated stress responses and during the separation phase, and then their heart rate stayed high. They didn't calm down the way the mothers who were quote-unquote control moms did, so that the heart level stayed high during the free play session. And these mothers, rather than being unengaged, were actually overly engaged. They had the highest levels of hostility, more angry tones of voice, more derogatory comments, more rough physical interaction. So these mothers were unable to calm down and were walking around on high alert. So paradoxically, depression actually aggravates the alertness and sensitivity. I found that was interesting and not necessarily to be expected. Overall, what this shows is that stress is contagious. You can give it to your children, and they can give it to you. It's going to be very important in light of our burgeoning understanding of epigenetics, how important the mother-child or parent-child interaction is, that we really help people have ways of calming down. Maybe along with Lamaze breathing, we need to be teaching meditation to women during pregnancy so that when their baby is 17 or 18 months old and really annoying, they can go to that quiet place and get out of those me thoughts and bring things back into line appropriately with respect to their stress response. I'm going to do one more news story while I wait for your call. This one is really interesting study, again, touching on that epigenetics concept. This is a study using a toxin, TCDD, which was used as an herbicide during the Vietnam War. We know that fetal exposure, we know because we did the experiment during Vietnam in humans, that fetal exposure to this toxin is associated with preterm birth in a subsequent adult pregnancy. So meaning when the baby or fetus grows up, is female, has a baby, that she'll have preterm birth. And something else that this study found that we didn't know was that it's also true for the male. So a male who is exposed to this toxin, these are human males, in utero, when they grow up, the babies that they produce are also more likely to have preterm labor. And this also replicates in mice. So this study looked in mice, and they exposed females and males to this TCDD before birth, and both groups had about 40% preterm births, which was a big jump, and that was what they expected. In the next situation, they took these toxic exposed mice who were sort of fated by their epigenetics to have problems in pregnancy later on, and they fed them fish oil in their diet from birth until the time that they mated. And they completely reversed the toxic-induced preterm birth rate. So fish oil was very successful in alleviating this epigenetic change, which is just fascinating bit of information. And again, it's showing us more and more that the book of life, that our DNA is not written in stone, that it's in fact an editable file that we can influence with our behavior, with our diet, with healthy living. Now we're going to have to go back and restructure the entire medical system such that doctors actually learn more about healthy living and how to promote healthy living behaviors in their patients. That's not something that we are taught. We're taught all about diseases and all about the fixes for diseases. And we're taught prevention as it's focused on things like vaccinations and early detection of disease. And if you stop and think about it for a moment, preventing breast cancer by detecting it early is not preventing breast cancer. It's detecting it while it's still curable. If we really want to prevent breast cancer, we're going to need to change people's diets, exercise, and habits. So that's just not going to happen without a social decision to make that a priority. And we have so many drivers right now that are pushing things in the other direction that I really think we need to have a dialogue as a society. I'm going to take a moment and do a couple of emails. This one from Jacqueline in Santa Cruz. Can you tell me what to do after I got my lab test back stating that I have IgM for H. pylori? You may already have covered this topic. Please let me know. Jacqueline, we've covered H. pylori a lot, but I'm going to, because you got the IgM test, talk a little bit about it on the air. IgM is an early antibody. It's seen in the first couple of months of an infection, and after a year or so, it tends to disappear and be replaced by IgG. That means that your infection with H. pylori is probably recent, and in general, that's treated, well, it's looked for because you probably have symptoms, and it's treated with antibiotics and proton pump inhibitors. I heard reflected back at me the other day by a patient, oh, Dr. Dawn hates proton pump inhibitors. So let me clarify, I don't hate proton pump inhibitors. I think they're fabulous and fantastic drugs for short-term use. My complaint is that they're available over-the-counter and that people use them for years, causing adaptive changes in their bodies against the drug that actually perpetuate the problems that they were trying to solve with the drug in the first place. So, that being said, short-term use of a proton pump inhibitor with one or more antibiotics has about a 75% chance of eradicating H. pylori. And you can check for the eradication by using a breath test, which is now widely available from local labs, where after you think you've cleared the H. pylori, you can eat something that will be fermented by the H. pylori and then breathe into a paper bag. And if it's present, if the H. pylori is still alive, you will have a positive air test on your exhaled air. So that's a good way of checking to be sure that you cleared the infection. Hope that helps. And we're going to Sandy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sandy.
Mr. Don.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to let you know that there is a saltwater treated pool in the YMCA in Watsonville for anybody that has trouble exercising at Lorraine.
Okay. Tell me about a saltwater treated pool. How do they do that?
I'm not sure. I haven't read all their information yet, but apparently what it does is it makes less chlorine, and it's very good for people that are allergic to chlorine or have trouble with chlorine like I do with my asthma.
Right.
It's $45 a month to go there.
Well,
I think an enrollment fee.
Well, thank you very much for the information, Sandy, and that was the YMCA or the YWCA?
I think it's called the YMCA, and it's right next to the Pajaro Valley Art Center on 7th Street.
Okay, yes, I know that building well.
And it's a beautiful Olympic-sized pool.
And by the way, for those people who are locally, they've got a great art exhibit that's still going that I have a piece in, so I'll put
That's the Day of the Dead one?
Yeah, it's the Day of the Dead. Mi casa es tu casa. So I'll put a little plug in for that.
And I'll put a plug that it's a gorgeous show and worth seeing.
All right. Well, thank you, Sandy.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's talk to Erica in Soquel. Hello, Erica. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I had a comment and a question, and my comment was that about the information about the fish oil and how beneficial it is for altering the thing, as you're saying, and how fish oil is good for us on so many levels. And I was wondering if, as we know, like the coal-fired power plants are putting a lot of mercury out and in the ocean, and if that was going to affect the fish oil overall.
Actually, most of the high-quality fish oils have been prepared in an extraction process that gets rid of mercury. So there isn't a bioconcentration of mercury in most commercial fish oils. And, of course, they're very well aware of the issue and do check for it. Where you might get into trouble is the cheaper stuff because, if it's sourced out of the country and, just getting repackaged here, then you want to see the certificate from the company that they're actually testing it.
Okay. All right. My other question is, probiotics help a lot with having a lot of gas in your intestine? First of all, is having a lot of gas a sign that you need more probiotics?
It can be, but it can also be a sign that you're not digesting a carbohydrate correctly. Some people don't, for example, make an enzyme called lactase, so they can't break down the carbohydrate in milk sugar, lactose. Those people will have gas from dairy products, even though it's not related to a problem with their bacteria. They could have great bacteria, but they're not breaking down the sugar themselves, so the bacteria get it and get their little fimbriae on it and start turning it into gas. So that's one possibility, is maldigestion, we call that. And the other possibility is that you do have an overgrowth. A good indicator is timing, but there's something called small intestine bacterial overgrowth, where you have too many bacteria high up in your stomach. And people who experience bloating very quickly after eating, like a half an hour afterwards, particularly if they have to loosen their belt, that's generally a bacterial overgrowth syndrome. And you can check for the difference by simply taking digestive enzymes, which are available at any health food store. So you get a good broad spectrum digestive enzyme and eat a variety of different foods for a day, taking, three or four digestive enzymes before you eat, and you do a fart count. And then you compare that to your baseline fart count and decide whether or not the enzymes have made a difference.
Oh, okay.
So that'd be a way of solving it for you. And besides which, imagine what fun you'll have tweeting to all of your friends every time you toot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll take one more caller before the break, and that is Heather in Aromas. Hello, Heather.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you. Love your show. Wondering if you could comment on any general suggestions. I have scheduled a surgery for removal of my uterus and one ovary, due to dermoid and various fibroids that are pressing on my bladder, etc. And rather than comment on the pros and cons of the surgery itself, more preparation. This is scheduled for the 22nd of December, and I'm looking for whether it's realistic to think I might, on short term, kind of clear up some of my body, getting it ready for the surgery. And I work full time. It's not okay to kind of hang by the toilet for 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, how much are you having in the way of pain medication?
That's not an issue.
Okay, so you're not having to use non-steroidals or anti-inflammatories every day?
Correct.
Okay, good.
I do use baclofen at night because I'm a paraplegic and have spasticity. So to sleep at night, 40 milligrams of baclofen has been sufficient.
Okay. Wow, so you're pretty productive given the challenges that you face, and I'm certainly wanting to wish you the best of success for your current problems. I would encourage you to cut back on pain meds, Tylenol, alcohol, reduce your caffeine consumption if you can. We don't want you doing lots of high-dose fish oil because this is a major surgery and that does have a blood-thinning effect. They will give you antibiotics at the time of your surgery. This is done intravenously, and it can create some follow-up problems in the GI tract, so I do recommend using probiotics and, having some afterwards in the early post-op phases. See if you can get your doctor to write, as soon as you go home, of course, start the probiotics. But you might even try to see if the doctor will write for some probiotics in the hospital. There is actually a brand on the formulary at Dominican. I'm not sure if Sutter has that on their formulary, but it would surprise me if they didn't. And if they don't, they should. So I really am a strong advocate for getting the bowel flora back in shape as quickly as possible after an antibiotic exposure. The high-protein diet will help you with healing, so being sure that you eat lots of clean protein, not so much starch and carbohydrates. If you do have a weight issue, cutting back on the carbs and having a healthy blood sugar going into something like this also helps with your post-op complications, and it makes you less inflamed, which is great because you're going to have a massive inflammatory hit when they start cutting on you.
That's very helpful. In the past, for inflammation, I've used just the bromelain, the pineapple extract, and also some tart cherry syrup. I'm wondering any other suggestions for either pre- or post-surgery inflammation.
Curcumin, the compound that's found in turmeric, the spice, that yellow spice of curry. And curcumin extracts are out there as commercial products. Thorne makes one called Meriva, M-E-R-I-V-A, and there's a product that I see on most pharmacy shelves called Zyflamend, Z-Y, that also contains curcumin and seems to be fairly well absorbed.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
You too.
Happy New You. Let's talk about waistlines. This is definitely the time of year when you can't walk 10 feet without encountering candy or cookies or cakes or large-scale representations of the same emblazoned across every billboard and sprinkling. Even the shoe store has candy canes on its windows. So what's a person to do? I thought that I would suggest an old-fashioned remedy, a tape measure. The reason I'm talking about tape measures is really to raise awareness of visceral body fat. And we have a real problem with diabetes in this country. We have a problem with hypertension, all diseases of lifestyle. And part of what drives that is fat in the mesentery, fat around the intestines. Body fat in the abdomen, that sort of pregnant male look that so many men in our culture get in their 40s and 50s, is a sign that fat is accumulating around the arteries in the heart, around the viscera, around the liver, and it's a toxic sort of fat that produces hormones that actually make you hungry and are pro-inflammatory and pro-coagulant. And we know all of this science. And we're watching this phenomenon happen as an entire generation of young people is, well, showing up with a different body phenotype as young as grade school. And that phenotype is going to carry them to premature morbidity and mortality. So what does it take? It takes a tape measure. If you are an adult female and you are more than 35 inches at the belly button, you probably have major visceral fat issues. Another way to look at it is the gut to butt ratio. You measure around the widest part of your butt. And as a female, the ratio should be 4/5 or 0.8. In other words, a fifth smaller than your hip measurements or you've got trouble. In males, the ratio is 1:1. So if your gut is bigger than your butt, it's time to change your behavior. We're talking now to Kathleen in Santa Cruz. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I love your show. I love your art. And I have a question. I'm so nervous. I don't know why. Anyway, recently I've had an endoscopy. I've had acid reflux for quite a while. I resisted taking proton pump inhibitors. Is that right?
Right.
After the endoscopy, I found out that I had inflammation from my esophagus all the way to my gut. And I was put on 40 milligrams of
Omeprazole.
Yeah.
That's
twice a day.
That's Prilosec.
That's Prilosec.
Big wonkin' dose of Prilosec.
It's huge.
And you said you had inflammation from your esophagus all the way through your system, though? In your large intestine as well?
Yeah, everywhere.
Okay. That's very interesting.
And I also will tell you, I was put on carafate. I presume I have ulcers. Carafate?
Well, yes, carafate will coat the surface of an ulcer. Sometimes we'll use it when there's a gastritis or maybe little micro ulcers.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's a good bet that you have some ulceration and that's why they put you on that. So I can understand there being too much acid and the proton pump inhibitor being used for inflammation of the esophagus, stomach, and duodenum. But when the inflammation gets down into the large intestine and the distal ileum, it generally has a different cause rather than just acid, because the natural pH in that area is quite, not alkaline, but, you know, fairly neutral, you know, in between 6 and 8 for the most part. So I'm wondering if you might also have some other inflammatory issue going on, either infectious or autoimmune in your intestines.
Well, I'm wondering if I did say that correctly. I'm trying to find the pictures that I got there. The pictures show that I have it through my stomach, and what you're saying is that.
Okay. Yeah. If it's
so,
just,
maybe it.
They didn't do the bot. They didn't go up your behind then and tell you.
No.
What it, okay.
No.
No. All right. I miss.
Yeah.
I think
sorry.
We miscommunicated there. That's fine. So tell me your question again.
Okay. My question is, I talked to the gastroenterologist, and he said just stay on these and gradually withdraw them. I would like to get off of the proton pump inhibitors completely.
Mm-hmm.
Since I found out I had this condition, I did get a wedge, so I sleep on a wedge. I just don't like taking all these.
Right, right. Of course not.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with, you've got to get it healed.
Right.
And then you've got to eliminate the factors that led to the problem in the first place.
Right.
Right? It's sort of like, okay, this happened for a reason. So once we get it healed, then we have to go and say, okay, what were the perpetuating and provoking factors? Sometimes people get started because they had a gastroenteritis and they were vomiting and they just vomited up a lot of acid and irritated their esophagus. And a situation like that, you probably don't need major lifestyle changes. But let's just go through the lifestyle changes that you're going to be following very carefully for the next 3 or 4 months, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so you got the wedge. That's a start. You don't want to sleep flat. You sleep slightly elevated because that helps acid remain in the stomach. Door number two, you can't eat or drink anything for 2 hours before lying down at night.
Right.
And you can't go and sit in the Lazy Boy recliner and put your feet up after dinner either. That counts as lying down.
Uh-huh.
So you have to remain upright.
I do all those.
Really important. Also, you need to remove things in your diet that might be drivers for this, and that would be caffeine, alcohol, aspirin, ibuprofen, and the other anti-inflammatory drugs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I do that too.
Good.
I was told to go off caffeine.
Right, good, because caffeine loosens the sphincter and makes it easier for acid to belch up the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
So you have to first get the esophagus healed, and that generally takes between 2 and 6 weeks.
Uh-huh.
At that point, I usually recommend that people go off of the proton pump inhibitor and go on an H2 blocker like Zantac or Tagamet and continue to take something at night, because nocturnal reflux is a big driver that keeps this sort of thing going.
Uh-huh.
All right, so you take something at night to reduce the acid and you continue to behave yourself from a lifestyle standpoint.
But what about probiotics?
Well, I think probiotics are really helpful for a lot of intestinal difficulties, but most of the time this kind of esophagitis is not due to a dysbiosis.
Uh-huh.
Now, there can be exceptions, but for the most part, probiotics are probably not pivotal here. It's more mechanical things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so then once you're on that nocturnal H2 blocker at bedtime, then you are paying very close attention to symptoms.
Right.
And if you are not having any symptoms and you've been continuing all the lifestyle things, then you get scoped again and look and make sure you've healed everything up. Then you know that you can continue in that course and maybe eventually drop the H2 blocker. By the way, if you're overweight, losing weight can be very helpful as well.
Right. When I questioned him about getting rid of all this acid, I asked him about, don't we need acid? And I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was sort of like, you don't. And that confused me, because my understanding was that we need the acid to, digest food?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I would have to respectfully disagree with your gastroenterologist, but I think what you got was a simple one-liner. You know, it's a nuanced issue, and we don't get paid for nuance in this country.
Okay.
But overall, I think that short-term use of a proton pump inhibitor in a situation like this is entirely appropriate.
Okay.
And then long-term, you know, we don't just Well, if the symptoms come back, go back on it and stay on it forever. If the symptoms come back, then you're going to get a hold of me and we'll problem solve and figure that out.
Oh, thank you. The other thing that drove me to get the endoscopy, my sister happens to have Barrett's esophagus.
Which is a condition where there's chronic inflammation of the esophagus for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And Barrett's is considered a precancerous change.
Right, that's what freaked me out.
Essentially, the esophagus gets a callus on it because it's had so much acid, it changes epigenetically and opens up different DNA and turns itself into a callus to avoid the recurrent injury.
Uh-huh.
It's not that the Barrett's is bad, it's that the injury is bad
mm-hmm.
when you see that.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Good luck to you.
Thank you, bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Al in Paso Robles. Hello, Al. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
Dr. Don, excuse me. I just recently had a stone removed from my bladder. And afterwards, my bowel movement has been unusual. I go multiple times during the day, and after the first, generally speaking, the first bowel movement is very solid, but after that, it tends to be on the soft side and late in the day running.
Okay, let me just interrupt then. Yes. Antibiotics. Did they give you antibiotics during your procedure? I bet you they did.
Of course, I was out like a light,
yeah,
but
I bet you
afterwards,
they did.
Yes.
Yeah. And they're instrumenting your genital urinary tract. So even though it's done sterilely, there's still certainly a risk of creating an infection. So this is a routine thing that's done. And whenever
right.
anyone has a procedure where I infer that they would have had antibiotics intravenously, and then their bowel gets disrupted, the balance of nature has been thrown off. And another possibility also is, but generally in the direction of constipation, is the pain medications that you may have been taking because of the stone. But so your problem seems to be more in terms of frequency. So I think you have probably inadvertently been given a dysbiosis by your doctors who had nothing but good intentions towards you. And it might be that it would clear up quite well with probiotics. There is a test you should get. It's an antigen test. An antigen is a barcode on the surface of a bacteria. And in this case, it's an antigen test for the bacteria Clostridia difficile, C. diff, which is a common opportunistic bacteria that's present in small amounts in the intestine, but usually is kept in check by all the other bacteria. When you take antibiotics, however, and those bacteria are destroyed, C. difficile is resistant to almost all antibiotics. So it's the last man standing, so to speak, and can kind of take over the GI tract. So you do need to get that test because treatment for that would be much more than just probiotics. It would also involve vancomycin or metronidazole or one of the other few remaining antibiotics that that entity actually responds to. So I'm sorry we lost you there on the call, but hopefully I was able to answer your question. Let's go now to Elizabeth in Salinas. Hello, Elizabeth. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good. I just turned in this morning and I was hearing you talking about all this intestinal information, and I think it's great. And at the same time, here is my situation. I was administered a pneumonia vaccine at the age of 41 years old at my request. And the number of problems that I have ever since, besides what I have now, is this burping situation where I eat something and I start burping very strong. And sometimes it's so strong that I will feel that I'm out of breath. But it's not the case. It's that I have to burp first out and then like take a breath in. And it seems like if I'm allergic to something, when I eat something and I become allergic, and that's when the burping begins. But at the same time, it also, I feel it on my head. Something is inside my head. And I don't know the relation of it. And I had my H. pylori checked. I'm okay. No bacteria in my stomach. Mm-hmm. And my doctor can find what's wrong with me. What would the burping be related to?
Well, the most common cause of burping, of course, is air in the stomach. Sometimes people will, and I don't quite know how this gets started, but they'll develop a habit of taking a deep breath, and then at the top of the breath, they'll swallow. And they can actually swallow a fair amount of air. improper running or exercise technique will also lead to swallowing air, and then you'll have distension and belching. I'd mentioned earlier that burping right after eating is associated with a dysbiosis, in other words, abnormal bacteria in the stomach. That would be invisible to the gastroenterologist if he was looking with an instrument and doing a CLO test, which is the test that we do for H. pylori. You would be told, oh, there's no bacteria in there, but it would be that specifically there is no H. pylori bacteria in there, and that's the only one we look for. So there may have been a little bit of miscommunication there, but those are two possibilities. You are, you know, indexing this in time to when you had the pneumonia vaccine, and that is probably not causal in the sense that I'm having a real hard time coming up with any kind of mechanism that the pneumonia vaccine could cause this symptom, even though that symptom may have started around the same time. Coincidences do occur, and we are adapted to make associations. It's hardwired into our brains. So I think this might be not causal, not the reason that you have this. Where I would go now is get a barium swallow test where you drink some barium liquid and see if your lower esophageal sphincter is intact, that make sure that you are swallowing stuff and that it's going down and staying down. And that can be done with a barium study. That's probably where I would start, because structural abnormalities such as a hiatal hernia can happen, you know, all of a sudden. And you're describing something that happened suddenly. So we have to think in terms of what are the things that would happen suddenly and look for those.
So then I would ask for a barium testing?
Yeah, ask for a barium esophageal study to look and make sure that the motility of the esophagus is correct.
Okay. Alrighty. Now, with part of the vaccine, I had an Epstein-Barr virus that went Richter scale on me, and I thought, well, could that have also been what caused?
Well, when you get a vaccination, it can upregulate your immune system. So if you had antibody to Epstein-Barr because you were exposed, you might see a bump in your titer, even though you weren't re-exposed, just from the nonspecific augmentation effect of a vaccine. Again, I don't see a direct connection to the belching issue.
Already, so I'll start with barium testing, and so far as eating or anything like that, there's no specific recommendations.
If you listen to the earlier part of the program, I did talk about trying digestive enzymes for belching. And be sure that you aren't taking deep breaths, you know, because of anxiety and trying to calm down, that you aren't taking deep breaths and then swallowing at the same time.
Oh, okay.
Okay, check for that.
All right, thank you so much.
All right, good luck. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
And we're going to talk now to Edward in Salinas. Hello, Edward. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Don. I really appreciate your show. You're the best. Bowel movements. For the last 10 years at least, I get more severe inflammatory pain, particularly in the legs or whatever, for 5 or 10 minutes before bowel movement is needed. Any insight on that? I really am curious about it.
Well, I think that what's happening is that the distension of your colon is having an effect on the nerves that come out down there in the sacral plexus, and you're getting some radiation into the posterior thighs. So it's likely that the nerves are maybe a little irritated, and there may actually be physical pressure. Perhaps over time your colon's become a little bit floppier. You know, things do tend to get floppy with age. Mm-hmm. And so there may be an actual physical impingement. It's also possible that the spinal nerves themselves are a little irritable, and you could have spasm of the deep muscles that run right by the colon, and they could be going into spasm when they're pushed on by the stool in your colon. And so there's, you know, a lot of wiring, just thinking about the wiring diagram and the physical structures that are down there, it's probably something along those lines. Definitely don't bear down when you're pooping, you know.
This is, you know, 5 or 10 minutes before I even feel like pooping or any kind of, you know.
Right, I understand. It's sort of your early warning signal now.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably as soon as you get that sensation, you should go to the bathroom and have a go at it.
Right, yeah.
Don't even wait for the feeling of rectal distension. Because if I'm right and your colon has stretched out, that rectal distension may not actually be happening until quite late.
So exercise and get a firmer gut would be a good idea, anything like that?
I don't think sit-ups are going to make a difference here. So when you say a firmer gut, you know, the outside abdominal wall really doesn't have much of a factor. It's possible if the iliopsoas muscles are in spasm that stretching, particularly things like the cobra stretch and some of the yoga moves, might be worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
You could consider asking for a physical therapy evaluation and having them check those deep hip flexors to see if they're contracted. And if they are, then putting you on a program for that could be beneficial.
Wonderful. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Don.
Bye-bye. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.